ID, the future. A podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Hello, I'm Tom Gilson. What do you get when an honest, philosophical inquirer about intelligent design meets a leading scientific insider? You get the scientist, Michael Behe, fielding questions like whether bad design equals no design, or whether science ought to hold out for a better naturalistic evolution theory someday, or suppose, Dr. Behe, you've just been elected president of the National Academy of Sciences. What's the first thing you tell all the biologists? It's the third and final part of Michael Behe's conversation with philosophers Pat Flynn and Jim Madden, hosted on Pat Flynn's podcast and YouTube channel. Pat Flynn begins by reflecting on two fundamental difficulties with evolution and wondering when evolutionists will start deciding they've got a problem to deal with.
So one more point, because I want to say your case is at least twofold, right? One is that we have this sort of broad conceptual difficulty with Darwin's theory. It predicts something, and what it predicts is not what we see, right? It would not lead us to expect irreducibly complex systems. We find those. This seems itself to be a strong mark against Darwin's theory. But then you have a further case, and that case is, well, now we've actually been able to test Darwin's theory as well. And what we find is that it doesn't build complex new systems at all. And it mostly functions by breaking, blunting, or degrading. Right. Exactly. So we have like two fundamental difficulties here. And I guess the question is like, yeah, you can always give stories, right? But at what point do you give up on those stories, right? I guess there's no logical impossibility for me of thinking that the Great Pyramids were built by a series of sandstorms. I guess that's logically possible, right? Yeah. But it seems like there's a huge conceptual difficulty in imagining that, and there's tons of empirical evidence against it. And right?
Especially if you... you know, then go inside the pyramids and you see the structure inside of them, makes it even worse for an accidental. And that's what we're doing in biology as it probes deeper and deeper.
Yeah.
You know, on that though, Pat, I mean, and this might beg lots of questions, but I think the reply you're going to get is, yeah, well, what if the sandstorm hypothesis taken in isolation is a probabilistic bottom feeder, right? Okay. But if it's an entailment of a theory that's got a lot going for it, that's got a lot of probabilities behind it, then it seems like you're going to accept that probabilistic bottom feeder, you know, as the best we can do at the moment, and kind of hold out to see if somehow the theory can be revised so that we can cut down on those low probabilities. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's more what, and maybe Mike would say, no, we know enough now that Darwinism is not that good overall. Okay. But I think one could make the case is, yeah, I'm agreeing. It's way, way low probability. You're going to get the propulsion system of the bacteria out of this thing. Right. But that particular low probability is going to piggyback on all these other very good explanations we can give with this theory, such that we're not going to chuck the whole thing, right, for this one bad case. And like every scientific theory has this problem, right?
So, Jim, would you say that that's it? Like, again, evolution accordion term, right? Would you say, well, evolution in the widest sense seems to explain a great amount of data, and so that should consider us to, you know, give more credence to the mechanism in particular? Is that what you're saying? Or do you think?
I think it's kind of just a, you know, so every theory on the edges is going to have empirical problems, right? It's going to run into like really recalcitrant cases and data that it's going to have a hard time dealing with, right? And the degree that we're going to accept the kind of like ad hoc, low probability explanations that we have to make in those tough cases will be determined by how good the theory is overall, right? Mm-hmm. So I agree with you. Like, we could come up with some really bad ad hoc, you know, sand fairy theory of how the winds could build the pyramids, right? And it would be just stupid because it's not embedded in overall well-confirmed theory. Right. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's something that both you guys would argue with is, well, if evolution by natural selection is an overall well-confirmed theory, that might be enough to like boost these otherwise low probability ad hoc explanations we have to give in these really tough cases, like the, in the irreducible complexities?
Well, two things. Well, maybe one thing. The other one slipped my mind.
Sorry. I talked too much.
No. One is that you have to be careful in talking about evolution, as we all have admitted here, because it can mean different things in different usages. And in particular, there are two major things. One is common descent, that is, our organisms descended from each other. And the second is Darwin's theory that they can be, organisms can be built up by random changes and natural selection. The first one, there's lots of evidence for. The second one, there is zippo evidence for, that Darwin theory can build complex systems. And as I think I said in the beginning of the program, that is what has 99.9% of the philosophical and theological and even scientific impact. It's not that, you know, dogs are descended from wolves. Mm-hmm. What's more, when you think about common descent, I have argued that it's actually trivial. It's a trivial thing because it says that, oh, you've got two organisms, they have some common feature, but they are different species or something. Mm-hmm. So back in the misty past, maybe if an ancestor had that feature and later different lines developed, well, then maybe, you know, it would explain why these two have it. Okay, let's say that's true. But number one, it doesn't explain the feature. It posits it that the ancestor has it. Yeah. And that by itself does not explain how you get the two new species. So pretty much it says, well, these guys are related, but we don't know why they are different organisms. We don't know where these features came from, you know. And again, I think that's, you know, it might be an interesting fact about natural history, but as far as anything deeper goes, it's pretty trivial.
So Mike, you would say the problem here isn't at the edges. I agree with you, Jim. You know, we do have these problems at the edges of various scientific theories. But Mike, would you say the problem is dead in the center?
The problem is Darwin's mechanism. Mm-hmm. And that is the heart of evolution.
That's, you know, pretty center.
Lamarck and other folks proposed that organisms were related and changed and stuff over time well before Darwin did. But it was always a sort of teleological or inbuilt or process. And Darwin's claim to fame was not that organisms descend, but that he said he had thought of an utterly unguided, unintelligent process, you know, as unguided as which way the wind blows, that could account for eyes and giraffe necks and also wings of eagles and so on. And that is exactly the part that has zero to very negative amounts of evidence for it.
Right. Mike, would you mind if we took a question or two that were sent in?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Great. Cool. And then Jim, if you had anything else you wanted to discuss, please bring it up too, because I know that this is, This is relevant to some of the things you've been writing about related to mind, which is always fascinating. So here's a question, Mike. This is a common one. This is from Peyton. He says, how would you respond to the claim that ID can't be validated because cases that imply design can be matched by instances of what seem to be critical design flaws? Animals often seem poorly conceived. So the old argument from dysteleology, right? Mike, what's your response to this?
Well, dysteleology is a classic argument from ignorance. It essentially says, I don't know why that thing is there. Looks pretty silly to me. Therefore, nobody would have made it that way. So you don't have positive evidence that argues that nobody would do it this way. You're just making your own judgment. And those sorts of judgments have a very poor track record in biology. Just to take one, you know, a lot of people did and still do point to the blind spot, the so-called blind spot in the eye, and say that it's evidence of bad design because they would have designed it differently. Yeah. And you say, well, okay, why don't you go ahead and build yourself an eyeball the other way and show us how much better it is. Mm-hmm. But a series of papers has shown that the backward, or that the wiring of the eye is in fact optimal, that there are cells in the retina that channel light directly from the retina down to directly from the surface of the retina down to the nerves of the optic nerve, and they don't come and the blind spot doesn't interfere with those. Mm-hmm. Additionally, the arrangement makes it easier to supply the retina, which is a very high metabolic needs because it's constantly being bombarded with light and so on. It makes it easier to supply those repairs and nutrients and so on.
Right.
So the point is that just because you think that you would have done something different is not an argument that it's bad. You know, these are the eyeballs that eagles use to see prey from a mile or two away.
Right.
So this is more or less, well, it's an argument from ignorance.
Yeah. So that's, you know, this one is always fascinating for a couple of reasons is even if you think that something is poorly designed, and maybe it isn't, because just because you don't see the purpose doesn't mean that you see there is no purpose, right? There might just be design constraints that you don't realize, for example, right?
Exactly.
But even if you think something is poorly designed, and I'll give an example of something I think is poorly designed. My mom used to drive a Pontiac Aztec. And and I've always thought it was poorly designed, but at no point did I think that it didn't have a designer.
Exactly.
Most of it was just a bad one, right? So that's kind of a cheeky response, but like design is design, whether it's good or bad, right? Now, the other thing that strikes me about this argument is it really just seems to be a species of the problem of evil generally, right? Because the question is like, why would God let bad things happen? And this is just a particular species of that. That's really what it comes down to. And then my response to that is, if you're going to ask a theological question, you better be willing to accept the theological response. But now we're just beyond doing science anymore.
Right? Change the game.
Right.
The game starts.
There was a member of the National Academy of Sciences, a guy named John Avise, who's an evolutionary biologist. He wrote an entire book about why the genome is not intelligently designed. And almost all of his arguments were of this type, that if you break a certain gene, then you smell bad because it allows this ammonium containing compound to escape from your skin and so on. Mm-hmm. And he had a chapter devoted to my stuff in Darwin's Black Box. And he did nothing more than kind of wave his hands at that. So, a lot of people get confused that, you know, number one, things might be more complicated than you can tell. And perhaps what you think is not the right design is, in fact, better. Number two, that life has a history and that accidents and damage can happen over the long term. And so you would not expect everything to necessarily be in pristine shape, just like the Aztec. It probably had a few scratches and bumps on it. And it says nothing. It still says nothing about how dark an intelligent mechanism could build these things.
Right. Right. Jim, do you have anything else that you wanted to put out there from kind of the way that you've thought about this?
Yeah. So Kant distinguishes between ordinary sense perception and aesthetic perception, the perception of beauty. by when you, he thinks when you perceive something beautiful, it has a purposiveness without a purpose, that you look at it and it seems to be some kind of unified whole, right? That somebody is trying to tell you something with, okay, or seems to be up to something, even though you can't necessarily articulate what it is, right? Or the ability to articulate what the purpose of it would is independent from your perception of the purposiveness of it, right? And he thinks that's what's behind aesthetic judgments, that we find that kind of the coherence of what we're perceiving, like through our senses and emotions, is sort of cohering with reason, even though we can't really say how. Okay. And for Kant, the entire scientific endeavor presupposes the aesthetic judgment, right? Mm-hmm. Because what happens is you perceive a law, you perceive a unity, but then there's always this, well, it's got to fit into something broader, right? Uh-huh. It's got to fit into some broader explanation, even though I don't know what it is. So he thinks it's an aesthetic kind of judgment, right? Uh-huh. It's an emotional kind of judgment that keeps the scientific endeavor up and running. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now Kant thinks an aesthetic judgment can never lead to a grounded scientific inference, but yet it keeps us motivated to look for stuff. Okay. Uh-huh. And at the end of the day, when pressed, Kant will say, yeah, if you were to say, and therefore the whole thing is designed by a benevolent creator, he says that is not crazy. He thinks that would rightly satisfy like the eyes of faith. But he also thinks if someone says, well, wait, no, it's just because we're committed to an open-ended scientific process, right, that we keep doing it, and I'm not going to make that inference. He also thinks that's not crazy either, right? Uh-huh. And so I think this is end of the day, like kind of where I am on the ID thing, and Pat will see this. It's a similar view I have in other regions too, right, is that you could look at this
thing. I'm still convinced Jim's a Humean. He just said
I'm showing a different card. It's a Kantian card, right? is that you could look at this evidence. I think, yeah, if you made the inference that, yeah, ergo, this confirms some things I'm committed to, right? And the fact that the very scientific progress, process presupposes this kind of commitment to there being somebody trying to tell me something by the universe is not an insignificant datum, though I don't think it proves anything, right? You see my point, right? And so I think I would look at someone like yourself and say, yeah, I don't think that you're off anywhere, right, in what you're doing, right? And I might even follow you there, right? But I also think that it is a leap, maybe an in principle too big a leap to say from any kind of something like natural science that is open-ended, that there can be further discovery that would overturn things, to say that someone refusing to make that same inference that you and I might make is somehow an error. I think that's too far. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's
a lot, by the
fine,
way.
But that's fine. But I just refer back to my talking about the Big Bang theory, mm-hmm. that somebody could always say, well, you know, science might in the future have a better explanation, which preserves the static, eternal nature of the universe. Yeah. Right now, yep. which is what science can deal with right now, the positive evidence looks very much like it supports design. We know of no other process which could explain this, Darwin's theory notwithstanding. Mm-hmm. And so to withhold one's judgment in the hope of, I don't know what else would be a better explanation.
Thomas Nagel recently said, and I thought this is brilliant, that you can't like appeal to a possible future scientific revolution is not an explanation, right? Okay.
Yeah.
I agree. Right. But also I think if indeed, and this is an interesting question, if indeed what the ID asks us to do is to make an inference that is just inconsistent with, and not my view, but the view that people say is by bringing an interventionist teleological explanation into the picture, it's just contrary to the scientific method, right? That's not an explanation either. Do you see what I mean? And that's why for me, I'm kind of open to an agnosticism about the status of these arguments, right? But I actually think that that agnosticism is enough to confirm a prior commitment to something like religious belief, right?
Yeah. So two things here, just real quick to help frame it. and this was the actual kind of way I framed the topic of this conversation, is ID scientific? Now, the first thing that always concerned me, because what is scientific is, of course, a wonderful philosophical debate, right?
Yeah.
Is not whether it's scientific, but is it true, right? And I started off kind of just, I guess, a friendly agnostic, right? Like I was, you know, didn't really... or probably even worse than that, because for whatever reason, there's, and Jim, you'll know this, Mike, I'm sure you're familiar, since I was very much influenced by Thomism, I would say kind of, I don't know, maybe the general direction of the Thomists that influenced me tend to not be very friendly to ID, right? So
no, they're pretty frosty about it.
Right. So that actually kind of caused me to look away for a while.
Yeah.
But there were enough really smart Thomists who said, nah, like Rob Koons, for example, he's quite friendly to ID, that made me want to, and then I became like a friendly agnostic. Then I read Behe's books, loved them. And now I'm like, nah, I think this is right. I actually do. Now, if you read Michael Behe's Wikipedia page, it's like a 27 page hit piece on the guy. It's terrible. Yeah. But yeah, so two things here. One is that, yes, is this science? Should this be science? Is it a science stopper? But then also we could flip it, right, and ask, what might we be missing if we don't permit this as a valid science? Like, are we going to hurt ourselves in other ways if we don't at least have as an option on the explanatory table intelligent design? So however you want to respond to what Jim said and I said, Mike, take it away.
Mm-hmm. Oh, let's see. My capacity for remembering.
Thank you for your patience, Mike.
But let me just, for listeners who haven't heard before, why do I think ID is scientific? Because lots of people don't. Lots of scientists don't. It is scientific because it's based on detailed empirical observations. The molecular machinery of the cell, how cells and biological systems operate. This was all hard won by lots of experiments and so on. And number two, it uses normal modes of reasoning. Whenever we see parts that appear to have been put together for a purpose, like a mousetrap or such things, we always conclude that they required design because we can perceive purpose. That's not going to happen by chance. It's going to, it serves a purpose. And we know that minds have purposes and nothing else does. So I think it's scientific for those reasons. Empirical evidence is its basis and ordinary reasoning, just like every other scientific conclusion. Mm-hmm. Number two, what would we miss anything? We could miss a lot. If you think that evolution explains the fantastic molecular machinery of a cell and so on, then pretty much there's no problem that evolution couldn't get around. So if you were trying to design antibiotics, say, you would, you know, you might say that, well, this can't last. We can't design anything that will last forever. Evolution will always get around our antibiotics. And you might aim for short-term fixes here, try to tamp down fires over there, but you wouldn't necessarily try to design an antibiotic that nothing could get around, that no living organism could get around. You might see the cell as weird, doing weird things that, you know, you'd say, oh, that's evolution, you know. And it turns out later on that, in fact, it's doing really profound things. Now, you don't have to be an ID guy to do that, but you have to be, you don't have to be an admitted ID guy, but you do have to be an effective ID guy. You have to assume that everything's intelligently designed, but you'll call it evolution. Mm-hmm. So when you find systems biology, when you find deeper and deeper levels of regulatory networks and so on, you wouldn't have predicted those from evolution, from Darwinian evolution. But if you were an ID guy, you might be more ready to test the depths of life. And just one more point is that, yeah, it never ceases to annoy me that Thomists are, as you say, frosty towards intelligent design as a rule. There have been a number of great exceptions. And I haven't the foggiest idea why not, or why they are standoffish. It's true, as they have pointed out, that the scientific argument can't get you to God, let alone the God of Christian theology, but it gets you up a step. And if you look around at the society in which we live, you know, we could use that. The folks in general are not debating whether, say, Thomas or Duns Scotus had the better of an argument. They are debating, you know, whether Richard Dawkins proved that that atheism is true, and why look at all the things that evolution can do. That's where the real action is. Mm-hmm. I would love it if the majority of people were, you know, took it for granted that, you know, gravity and natural laws show that there has to be an intelligence behind the world, and we're debating about higher level questions. But in our society, they aren't. And one of the first arguments that you get from a Thomist when talking about intelligent design is that, oh, even if Darwin's theory is exactly true, that doesn't matter, because we know that, you know, shooting an arrow requires an agent. And only later on, as in Jim's paper that he hasn't read for 10 years, later on do they say, oh, well, by Darwin's theory, we don't mean one that claims that there's no God, or that there's no purpose or anything. We just mean, you know, a philosophically naive theory. Mm-hmm. But nobody in the general public takes Darwin's theory to be philosophically naive, or very few people. They all think, and the press is happy to tell them, and the leading lights of biology, like Dawkins, are happy to tell them too, that Darwin's theory means there is no direction, no intelligence whatsoever needed. Here, ID is just saying, well, you know, at least from our limited little sphere in biochemistry or cell biology, that's not true. Then I don't see why that offends Thomistic sensibilities. Yeah. And if you look at the reaction, the folks who say that, well, Thomas's fifth proof, you know, just is confined to, say, natural laws. None of the atheistic scientists cares about that, frankly. I mean, it's their mistake, but they don't.
Right.
But when I say, you know, modestly, I say, you know, yeah, I think common descent is true. I think, you know, there's mutation. I think natural selection certainly works. But you know what? I think in many cases that didn't happen by chance, but needed guidance or direction or programming or something. I've had the National Academy of Sciences condemn me by name. I've had, you know, the Council of Europe condemned intelligent design.
Alex Rosenberg lumped you in with, what was it, Stalin in one of his papers?
Yeah, that was great. I love that.
That was nice. That was real nice of him. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So it gets a big howl. And I think the point I'm making is that with all its limitations, it'd be nicer if Thomists would nonetheless, you know, you can make your limitation or your caveats later, but they always lead with the things that they don't like about ID.
I agree. It has actually come to annoy me quite a bit as well, because one, I think they're comparing apples to orangutans, right? It's like, you have said, first, one thing, let me just get off a couple of my annoyances. One is that Thomas themselves become really annoyed if you don't make the right distinctions between different schools of Thomism. Yet they never make the different distinctions between all the people in ID, right? Who say many different things, right? So they're like, these easy sort of hand-waving dismissals that they themselves get very annoyed about, rightfully so, they commit when it comes to ID. So like, yes, okay, if somebody in ID is an idealist or they hold to a mechanistic philosophy of nature, then the Thomists can rightfully object and give their arguments against that. But you can't dismiss Behe because he says and has said on this podcast many times, you don't hold to any, at least not, you don't advocate any particular philosophy of nature. You're making an empirical argument against the scientific theory. So one is just, I just think, an intellectual laziness and a sort of easy dismissal attitude that is, I think, unbecoming of anybody who wants to claim to be a Thomist or just a philosopher in general. The other thing I'll say is like, where is the incompatibility here, right? Is, you know, the Thomistic project, you know, we're doing metaphysics, you know, any finite thing exists only insofar as God imparts esse to a restricted essence. Great, right? And it can still be the case that that natural selection or random mutation cannot build irreducibly complex systems, right? Like I've yet to find a really good Thomist critique either of a strict incompatibility of these lines, and specifically your line of thought. That's why I always say it's Behe's books that I'm talking, because presumably there are people in ID that I would disagree with on things, right? And I'm sure you would as well. But I have not yet found what that incompatibility is, and I've really not found any Thomists, even Thomistic scientists, who've given. And I look to them specifically because I think like, all right, if anybody's going to have a good reputation, it should be somebody like this, the ID, to give empirical counter arguments to your claims. And I just haven't found anything on that front. Sorry, I had to get that off.
No, I think Thomists are subject to the same, you know, cultural professional pressures of anybody else working in the American university. Right. I mean, I think that's, and until they reach a certain level of prominence, all that, they're going to feel like they got a lead punch with that. Well, I'm not one of those guys, just so you know. I'm a theist, but I'm not one of those. Right.
And this is the sort of armchair sociology and psychology, but I've asked this to Mike before. I agree with you, Jim, because how much of this is just wanting to have a seat at the secular lunch table, right? How much of this is just not wanting to have a Wikipedia page that looks like Michael Behe's, right?
I'm in a professional situation where I'm more likely to get in trouble for disagreeing with Michael Behe than I am with agreeing with him, right?
Is that right?
So, I mean, not seriously, but if I were to get pushback from colleagues, it would be for what I. Yeah. My disagreements with you. Okay, good.
Well, I was at a meeting of the Fellowship of Catholic Scholars a couple years ago, and that was a point of disagreement. There were a lot of Thomists there who I gave a talk, and they were in line to ask questions afterwards, and antagonistic ones. But the thing that impressed me was a guy came up to me in the bar earlier and sat down. He says, you know, I teach at a Catholic college, but if I taught ID, I would be fired. And was clear that they didn't know what ID was, or they got their notion of ID from reading the New York Times stories about it or something.
Right.
I agree. That's human nature and life and stuff, but still can be annoying.
I was telling Jim before too, is that that I'm sure it'll happen here after this, you know, goes up on the podcast. Is there's like, you know, most of my audience is super cool, even if they disagree. We have a lot of good, like even Jim and I, like we have good clash a lot of times on ideas because we're adults, right? We can do that. But whenever I have an ID guy on, like I don't know where these people come from, right? Like you guys just attract a certain vitriol that I've never seen in any other type of conversation. So I don't know what that means, but it is a very unique thing. But my point is this, is that like you, Mike, I feel like I was misled on things that were not based in good evidence, about ID. Like you, I had no, especially since I wasn't had a particular religious commitment for a large part of my life. Like evolution, fine, right? No issue. And not only just misled on that, but also misled about what ID was too. Cause like, you know, I read the pop level articles and, you know, I heard from certain people that this was just pseudoscience or creationism in a tuxedo, a cheap tuxedo. It's never an expensive tuxedo. It's always a cheap tuxedo. Right. And so okay, smart guys are saying this and that frustrated me. So if nothing else, right, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm completely wrong on this. Maybe we're all wrong. Like if nothing else, I just feel like we could at least try and give it a fair hearing here on the Pat Flynn Show, right?
Yeah.
Nothing
we'll
else. Like, at least
we'll
do that.
Take it. Yeah, that's great.
So, Jim, did you have any final thoughts here? Mike, you've been super generous with our time, but I want to get you guys concluding remarks on anything.
You know, if I just – one last question, Mike. So if you, finally got your chairmanship at the National Academy of Sciences, right? And right? Uh-huh. You're running it now. What does the professional biology look like? Like if you had the ultimate kind of, you know, within the academic culture, not necessarily the broader American culture, but within the academic culture, if you got the effect you wanted, what would the discipline of biology look like at the university level?
Gee, it'd pretty much look like it does now, where 90%, 95% of people just work on how things work today. You know, what's going on in the cell. One of the differences would be that you wouldn't see gratuitous attributions of things to evolution, which occurs in journals and textbooks and all sorts of things. They'll say things like, isn't it wonderful that bacteria have evolved a flagellum to help them help them move. It's mostly the just a prior assumption that materialism, Darwinism, etc., has to be all the way down that. That I would change. Even evolutionary biology, you know, almost all of it is either on trivia or very small things. I know somebody who works on the evolution of birds, and she looks at Carolina finches versus Carolina chickadees versus black-capped chickadees. And if you looked at them, you wouldn't see any difference whatsoever. And yet they are supposed to have separated from each other 4 million years ago. And you say, you know, I would have expected more, you know, but, you know, okay, yeah, you can study questions like that. What distinguishes them? How did they change? But that is decidedly what they call microevolution. And folks who talk about macroevolution pretty much only compare DNA sequences, and they don't try to explain how things actually arose. So nobody in evolutionary biology is doing anything I think is, you know, off base. It's just that they all are pointed in the one direction. They're just assuming that random processes are responsible for all of life. They don't try to prove that. They assume that. And I just want to make them aware that they are begging the question royally, and hopefully have some folks turn to that and see what that portends for biological research.
Very cool.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah. So let me say this. You know, these conversations, we can only scratch the surface. If you really guys want the full account, then you have to get Dr. Behe's books. So, Mike, before we say goodbye, please recommend some of your works. I know you have two fairly recent books out. So if you could give us a brief idea of what those are and the best places to get them, that would be super appreciated.
Okay. The most recent book can be ordered on Amazon. Amazon.com. Most recent book is called A Mouse Trap for Darwin. It's a different kind. It is a collection of all my responses to criticisms going back 25 years to even before Darwin's Black Box was published up till now. And I urge people to get that just to judge the weight of the objections to ID and compared to my responses. Mm-hmm. Before that, in 2019, I mentioned is a book called Darwin Devolves. And I urge people to get that too, because I think it's the final nail in Darwin's coffin, because it shows that his mechanism does, you know, make small changes, which can help species a little bit in certain environments. But overwhelmingly, those adaptive beneficial mutations are ones that break genes or degrade them. The first book is called Darwin's Black Box, and that just kind of takes a tour of the biochemistry of the cell. It's only gotten more complex since the 1996 when it was published. And most people think of the cell as some squishy little thing. They don't think about it much in terms of evolution, and it shows that, you know, on the inside of the smallest layer, just like with, say, computers, you know, they might look complicated on the outside with a keyboard and stuff, but if you look inside, they're even more complicated. That's what biology has turned out to be. And the other book was published about 11 years after Darwin's Black Box, called The Edge of Evolution. And it looks to see what our best examples of evolution in nature show us. And I talk about malaria, which is widespread and which has a lot of cases every year, and show that the malarial parasite, which is a little single-celled organism, took a very, very long time to develop immunity to chloroquine, because it needed not one, it needed two coordinated mutations to occur before it had resistance to the drug chloroquine. And yet, if it takes such enormous population numbers and time and generations to get two crummy changes in a pre-existing protein, I argued that Darwin's mechanism, even if there weren't these other problems, couldn't account for the complexity we see.
Right. Excellent. So a cumulative case, as they often say. And again, I can't recommend the books enough. Again, no matter how you feel about this issue, it never hurts to just go read both sides and see where you think the evidence, the weight of the evidence is, as they say. Mm-hmm. So Dr. Behe, thank you so much. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. I always enjoy it. Jim, it's good to meet you. Pat, talk to you again sometime.
Thank you. It's been an honor, Mike. Appreciate it.
That was the third and final part of a podcast hosted by Pat Flynn on his YouTube channel, along with his co-host, Jim Madden, talking intelligent design with pioneering ID scientist, Dr. Michael Behe. It's republished here by Pat Flynn's permission. Stay tuned to ID the Future for more great thinking and conversation on ID and evolution, and please be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast app. For ID the Future, I'm Tom Gilson. Thank you for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is Copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.